I'm Jack Stilgo, lecturer in science policy at UCL's Department of Science and Technology Studies. And I'm joined by Jonathan Wolfe, professor of philosophy at UCL and also dean of arts and humanities here. And Jonathan's involvement in policy is interesting for all sorts of reasons, not just the range of policies that he has been involved in advising on, engaging with, but also the perspective that he brings. And Jonathan, I guess one of the interesting questions it really is what does a philosopher bring to policy discussions, given that we're conventionally, you know, we're more familiar thinking about evidence-based policy and science policy?
Well, that's a very good question. In some circles, there's an expectation that philosophers are particularly good at dealing with moral questions, and that there are very few issues that are pure scientific issues. That if you want to get involved in regulation of GM crops, more prosaic things like I've been involved with gambling, recreational drugs, of course you need to have evidence, but the evidence alone will never derive a set of conclusions. So you need some sort of normative premises to derive any policy. And committees often think that a philosopher will help them with that.
And is that true?
Well, I think it's true, but I don't think it's true in the way that they initially think it will be, or at least naively they might. Because there's a view of philosophers, I liken it to a type of secular preacher of some sort, that we're past the age now where we're looking for religious leaders to help us out, but we are looking for someone who will give us a steer on normative issues. And sometimes it's thought that the philosopher has some sort of special insight into ethical questions or some body of knowledge that can be brought to bear. But the trouble is that if you approach issues that way, and you just declare some moral beliefs and derive policies from it, the other people on the committee or people, policymakers you're engaged with, want to know what your evidence is for those moral views. And so you're back where you started. There is no evidence for them. And so they want something, but also deny the possibility of that very thing.
Right, because we ask our scientists, if you like, to stick to the evidence, you know, and leave the values for the people that we legitimately, you know, elect to make those decisions for us. And a philosopher would seem to sit rather problematically with that.
Right. So in that sense, the philosopher doesn't have a role, because it's not for the philosopher to override the democratic process, as you're saying, and it's not for the philosopher to provide scientific evidence, although, of course, we can sometimes question whether the evidence really is evidence for what the scientists are saying it demonstrates. So there are certain aspects in philosophy of science and epistemology that would be relevant to assessing evidence. But that's not normally what we're brought on for. We're brought in to try to go from the evidence to policy. And as we've said, that's not straightforward. So the way I tend to think about it is that typically we wouldn't be brought in as philosophers to a policy area unless there was a problem of some sort. That, you know, if things are going well, you don't ask a philosopher about it. So it's only when there's some type of public moral dilemma that we're even consulted. So if I think about things I've been asked to deal with lately, last year I was invited to a seminar in Cambridge to talk about minimum alcohol pricing. Mm. And so there was a health lobby that was saying that we ought to have a minimum price per unit of alcohol. There was a libertarian wing that said it shouldn't be for the government to intervene, an anti-paternalist view. And, of course, business will have their own views about what is right and wrong in this area. And that was an issue I was asked to give a presentation on the topic, not having thought about it before. So I said to the organizers, this isn't an area that I had any expertise in at all. I hadn't thought about it at all. But they said, well, you've thought about drugs. So if you thought about drugs, that must apply to alcohol as well. So come and tell us about alcohol. And I considered the question, came up with some views about unintended consequences of policies, and thinking, you know, what would actually happen if we introduced minimum pricing for alcohol? You know, if prices go up, demand goes down, people will drink less. Well, that's fairly naive economics if we're talking about people with a dependency. And if we're talking about poor people with a dependency, then what will happen is I'll either turn to crime or spend more of the household budget, meager household budget, on alcohol. So strangely, I found myself thinking that if we introduce minimum alcohol pricing, this could be bad for the health of the children of alcoholics, because they won't be eating as good food as they might have done. So thinking, you know, in those broader terms. Now, you don't have to be a philosopher to do that. And this is, in a way, how we almost disable ourselves, disable our qualifications. Because what we do, if we're thinking about it that way, a good civil servant or a good journalist or an intelligent person could also do. But still, I think philosophers, or any academics actually, if they have the right temperament, can do something that's useful. Because what we're used to doing is thinking about problems, not accepting easy answers to them, thinking about objections to other people's solutions, making distinctions, thinking, well, if you believe this, it follows that you better believe that other thing as well. So following through arguments, making distinctions, envisaging alternative possibilities, those sorts of conceptual questions are our stock in trade. And we are informed by, you know, great traditions of moral and political philosophy and other parts of philosophy. So what I think, now, so my cliche here, I'm sorry for delivering a cliche to you, is that public policy doesn't need philosophy, but it does need philosophers, i.e. people who've got the skills that they've derived from their philosophical education. But I wouldn't want to say that philosophers are the only people who can do this sort of thing.
I would agree, I think, you know, having observed scientific advice in practice, I would agree that that a philosopher can serve all sorts of useful roles, and including but not just limited to the ones that you mentioned. I think there's also just there's a role to be played, which is just in challenging and questioning the other evidence around that table, and I guess avoiding groupthink to use the popular term. But it means that you end up talking across a very wide range of policy areas, a wider range maybe than a scientist would feel comfortable. I mean, do you feel comfortable doing that? Coming, if you like, as you say, you know, you're not experienced in those particular issues, you're arriving and dealing with them fresh, but you still have something to bring.
Yeah. Well, the alcohol one was unusual because that was just a one-off seminar. But normally I won't allow myself to get involved in a policy issue unless I've got the time to look at it properly. And so for this reason, I'm not very keen on, you know, when I'm called up every now and again by Sky News to talk about some bit of gee whiz science that's just turned up and what are the moral implications. I want to think, well, give me a year and then I'll come back, because I want to read about the evidence, I want to read the debates, I want to talk to people, I want to find out. So in all of the policy areas that I've been seriously involved in, I've normally thought I need a year or two to get myself immersed in the debate, to understand the problems, and to understand that what we often think of as the solutions were the problems from the previous generation. Mm. That is, it's in policy areas, people talk about policy cycles, and this happens a lot in government because, you know, people have moved on very quickly. They hold a brief for 2 years, and then they go off and do something else, and someone comes back in again. And now in civil service, there's also very quick turnover, not much institutional memory. So quite often, you know, the gee whiz solution to something now was the problem that the current situation was meant to resolve. So you need to understand history, which actually scientists are not so fantastic about typically. And you also need to understand the difference between having the evidence and being able to make use of it in policy areas, given other types of resistance. So, for example, every committee I've sat on has at some point referred to what it calls, depending on who's around the table, either the Daily Mail test or the Daily Telegraph test, which is, you know, what would the newspapers make of this recommendation? And you know, one area where I've done quite a bit of work now is the regulation of recreational drugs. And if you're thinking about comparing alcohol and several soft drugs, there's just no doubt that alcohol is worse for you than ecstasy, cannabis. It's not to say that there are no harms with cannabis and ecstasy, but from a scientific point of view, it's mad that one is legal and the other is illegal. If we're going to have anything on the basis of harm, it should be the other way around. From a moral point of view, it's very hard to see what the justification is for one being illegal and the other legal. But from a political point of view, things may be slowly changing now, but for a long time it's been better for politicians to live with something that can't be scientifically or morally defended than to make any change. Because you start from where you are, and if you make a change and it goes wrong, then you're in a disastrous position. Whereas if all you're doing is keeping to the position which is long established in history, you're just doing the same as everyone else and can't really be blamed so much for it.
And that exact debate, of course, was what David Nutt fell foul of when he was ejected from his chairmanship of the Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs, I think, and that maybe understanding the scientific and political and moral lines of that debate isn't something that we can all do.
Well, I think that's absolutely right, and it's the drug debate, and particularly David Nutt's work, that made me realise the complexities of getting involved with policy. Because I knew of David Nutt's work before he was as famous as he is now, because he's been peddling the same line probably for 10 years. And one of the first things I read of his was a short paper called A Tale of Two E's, which compared ecstasy and ethanol. And he argues that ethanol is worse for you on every possible criteria than ecstasy. As far as I can tell, scientific evidence is pretty clear there. Yet, he was demonized for making similar remarks a few years later. He apologized for it, apologized for trivializing the debate. But it's very hard to see how he was trivializing the debate. But what he didn't understand at that time, he probably does now, is that a lot of policy and regulation has to do with a much more complex sociological worldview in which there are insider and outsider groups and insider and outside behaviors, and things are approved partly because of their history and social conventions rather than anything that the scientist could disturb. And I suppose the scientist's problem is that if a policy is not in the first instance based on evidence, then uncovering new evidence is not going to shake the policymakers. If there's something else that's driving it, then the scientific evidence will be irrelevant to the debate. And that's a hard thing for scientists to understand.
Very good. Jonathan Wolfe, thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks very much indeed.